cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. The Fan. On demand.
All right, welcome to Baseball Central for a Monday. I am Jeff Blair, joined alongside by Joe Siddle of our Blue Jays broadcast crew. This was the weekend that the American League East tightened up. The Toronto Blue Jays took 2 of 3 from the Texas Rangers ahead of a 4-game series against the Boston Red Sox, which starts tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet, live from the Rogers Center. First of 4 games, as I said. The Blue Jays, 3 back of the Baltimore Orioles, tied with the New York Yankees. And don't look now, but the Tampa Bay Rays have won 5 in a row. They're 7.5 back. The Boston Red Sox have won 4 in a row. They're 7.5 back. It's tightening up in the American League East, Joe, as a lot of us, a lot of us thought one of two things was going to happen. One, either everybody was going to be in and it would tighten up, or two, somebody was going to emerge right out of the All-Star break and run away with it. That doesn't appear to have happened.
Didn't you just think, though, that we'd be in this situation? I mean, you can never count out the Boston Red Sox, the Rays, definitely not the Yankees, and especially with the trade deadline coming up. You know the Yankees will do what they have to do. The unfortunate thing for them is they just don't have that wealth of prospects to perhaps get a player or two that they really need. But their pitchers are stepping up as well. So everybody's kind of beating up each other right now. And the big news, I think, for everybody in the division except the Orioles is that the Orioles are on a tough stretch right now starting out west.
Yeah, they really are. They are on the West Coast. They're playing an awful lot of good teams. And, I mean, the team that kind of interests me, because I had them picked at the start of the year as the team that was going to win the division, for a couple of reasons, are the Tampa Bay Rays. First of all, because they have played much better baseball in the past 6 weeks. As I said, they're in a 5-game winning streak. But beyond that, they've got the guy, David Price, that could be the guy that decides which way any number of pennant races go. If he is on the market, he will be the most sought after commodity. But Joe, if I'm Tampa Bay and I'm 7.5 back, and if I get to the trade deadline and I'm 5 back and, you know, 4.5 out of the wild card, I'm not trading David Price.
Well, I don't think so either. And I think especially, you just said it, nobody's really running away. The best run anybody in this division has really had is what the Blue Jays did back in May. And they've obviously lost ground since then. The Orioles have had their stretches, but nobody has really gotten real hot. And that's what's kept everybody in it. If you start playing well, like the Tampa Bay Rays have done, they're far from out of it. So I don't know if they're going to be thinking getting rid of David Price is the right move in 2014. This is a strange year for the American League East.
Yeah, it's, like I said, we've gone through 3 stages with this division. We've gone from sort of having a feeling that the Jays might open some ground on everybody else and sort of writing off the Red Sox and Tampa. And then we've gone to Baltimore possibly opening ground and teams and writing off Boston, Tampa, New York. And now we're back at it where, as I said, Boston and Tampa are both, they're both back in the picture. The Jays won 2 of 3 from the Texas Rangers on the weekend, capping the weekend with a 9-6 win over Texas yesterday at the Rogers Center. A sloppy game, 15 hits for the Jays, 12 hits for Texas. Casey Jansen needing to be bailed out by Aaron Loop. And Joe, I guess for a lot of people, the takeaway from this game, first of all, the Jays won a series, which is good. But I think a lot of people will look at Mark Burley's outing. 6 innings pitched, 8 hits, 5 earned runs, 3 walks, 5 Ks. And coupled with what we saw out of his previous start against Tampa, there may be some people there wondering whether or not Mark Burley's kind of coming back to earth. And I would suggest to him that, or I would suggest to them that at some point he was going to come back to earth.
Well, career numbers usually speak volumes, and we said it back in May and we continued to say it in June, although Mark Burley continued to prove us wrong the way he continued to pitch. But you don't expect, or you can't expect, Mark Burley to stay as hot as he was. He was absolutely outstanding, off the charts, best start of his career. And you have to expect that to come down a little bit. Now, he's been on a terrible losing stretch here in terms of decisions, but he had been pitching pretty well still, just not getting a lot of run support. But I think yesterday and his outing in Tampa before the break were both, to me, a little bit, not, I don't want to say red flags, but I think it was showing, it was an indication that you know, whether he's in that mid-season funk, that little dead arm funk. And I mean, I know he doesn't throw hard, high velocity guy, but when I say dead arm, that doesn't mean just losing velocity. What that means is losing sharpness and effectiveness of your pitches. Mark Burley lives on the corners and he is very good at it. He throws four different pitches. He's always away. He's always coming in. That's what he continues to do. He stays away from the middle of the plate. I thought yesterday and then against Tampa, too, he was upset, disappointed that his pitch count was spiked a little bit because he was falling behind a little bit more and missing his spots a little bit more. When you're missing your spots, you're just not as sharp and crisp with your delivery, and that can happen.
Speaking of falling, yesterday there was an incident, a balk called against Mark Burley where he stumbled delivering a pitch. He appeared to catch his cleat on the front of the mound. But before that, Joe, there was a play at first base. Actually, there were a couple of plays at first base where I thought Mark Burley looked a little slow getting over to the bag. Now, I'm not going to read anything into this, but I think it gets to what you said, and we were talking before the show. He just wasn't sharp. It was not the sort of sharp Mark Burley we expect to see.
No, and I think we've been spoiled for a few months,
sure,
too, because he's been so darn good that sometimes you pitch that well and now it's come to be expected of him. But as I said, I don't think when you see him start those first few months, I mean, he's on pace to go 27-2 with a 2.2 ERA. We knew that wasn't going to happen. So I think right now you have to realize that the numbers are just settling in for Mark Burley. They're settling back to the norm or back to where he should be. Now, because he started so well, for those numbers to go back to the norm, then he's obviously not going to pitch well. Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case, but you're starting to see that. He's human. He's not getting any younger. And you talk about him covering first base, and the one time he had to slide into first base there, I thought when I saw it, he may have jammed his ankle a little bit.
So did I.
I hope that is not the case, but we'll see. And yeah, that was a very unfortunate balk call, but I'll tell you what, if Mark Burley wants one pitch back from that game, it's after the balk call, and it's the two-run single by Robertson that really tied the game, and I think that's the one that he would love to have back that really disappointed him more than anything.
It's Baseball Central, brought to you by Home Hardware, Jeff Blair and Joe Siddle. Saturday, in the Blue Jays win, Marcus Stroman, the kind of start the team needed after Friday, but for a team that has... I'm going to bore the manager's phrase. John Gibbons says, we do look dead ass at times. And for a team that does look, quote unquote, dead ass at times, watching Marcus Stroman compete the way he competed and have that little touch of arrogance, boy, that was, I'll tell you, that was a tonic for that team.
Well, and you know, when you talk about kind of a laid-back team, when you're winning and hot like they were earlier in the season, that's okay. But when you're losing... You look at that team and say, gosh, they just look dead out there. They're not even showing up. And that's what losing does. It just brings out all the critics. But what happens with this team, I think, besides Kawasaki, who's pretty well energetic on a daily basis, and he's a lot of fun, breath of fresh air for this team. But what I loved about Marcus Stroman, number one, is that he pitched so well because this team desperately needed it after the loss against Yu Darvish Friday night. But Marcus Stroman, we've talked about it, he pitches with an air of confidence, arrogance, cockiness, call it whatever you want. But he's saying, I'm here and I'm here to get you out. And I think that from a young kid like Marcus, 23 years old, I got to believe the veterans around the club and everybody around the club has to feed off that and just love to watch that performance because that is kind of a quiet energy, I think, that it brings to the club.
He snapped off a couple of curveballs against Texas that looked like the curve he threw to Eric Hosmer of Kansas City, the one where Hosmer was caught in TV going, wow, as he walked back or as he looked at the pitch. He really did seem to do... I mean, that might be his second best curve of the year.
Well, I think like any pitcher, we talk about it all the time. I do on the broadcast. Fastball command is the most important thing for any pitcher. Now, when you have fastball command like Marcus Stroman and you're up around 94, 95, that helps even more. But to have a secondary pitch like that curveball, and he had it again yesterday, he got a few strikeouts. What really amazes me is he's striking out a lot of left-handers. And that's a dangerous zone to throw a breaking ball. You miss or spin one down and into a left-handed hitter, that's that lefty rake zone, they call it in baseball, where they just drop the head on it. For some reason, left-handed hitters handle that. But you get a lot of swing and misses, and that tells me that's a real sharp, late-breaking curveball. And he's really baffling a lot of hitters, but he just mixes in the change. He mixes in the cutter. He's also got a cutter around 90, 91, and he'll throw that either into lefties or away to righties and just to miss the barrel. And it's just a different look because then his regular fastball, and he's got some movement to it too. He's up around 94, 95, but to me, it's the fastball and curveball combination that's been so good for him.
Can we say, Joe, do you think, you know, it's very early in this guy's career, but does he look to you like the type of guy has a feel for pitching when people talk about having a that sort of innate second sense almost. Do you get the sense that even at this young age, he really does have a feel for what he has to do, as opposed to just going out there and, you know, just getting by and pure stuff and great athleticism?
Yeah, number one, I think he's very smart. And when you're very smart as a pitcher, you can start figuring things out a little bit. And I think that's what he does out there. Pitchers aren't always going to have their A game. They got to figure things out there. And the pitching coach can't hold your hand, and the catcher can't go out and coach you through it. You have to figure it out. And I think Marcus is the type of guy that can do that. I spoke with Deonner Navarro before the game that he pitched during batting practice that day, and I just asked him about his two breaking balls, because he throws a curveball and a slider, but then he's got the cutter and the changeup. But Deonner said, because I asked him, which one do you go to more, or how do you know? And he says, usually before the game in the bullpen, when he's warming up, whatever one's better, that's usually the one I will go to in the game. And then if it is in the game, he usually stays with it more than the other. It's a field pitch. They're both field pitches. But I've talked to Marcus before about this, and he feels that he can manipulate the baseball a little bit. He might have that curveball grip that he's, if he just doesn't have it that day, he might go to that slider grip pitch that he'll throw, and he may throw something in between. So it might be a curveball, it might be a slider. I know on the broadcast sometimes I just say breaking ball because I'm not sure which one it is, because I think he's out there manipulating that pitch.
Yeah, when I watch him pitch games like Saturdays, I'm not going to compare him to Pedro Martinez, but Pedro used to do that too. Pedro could
tinker with it a little
with the, and he would tell you that, you'd ask him. I can remember doing, when I was at the Montreal Gazette, we had this idea where we were going to take pictures of all the starting pitchers with their best grip for this story. And so Pedro, I got to know pretty well. They said, just out of interest sake, show me the number of grips you have, and we'll take pictures of all of them. And he did like about 11. but his point was, he said, just depending on the day, depending on the inning, depending if it's sweaty, depending what the grip is on the ball. And Pedro could do that because he had those
long fingers.
He had those long fingers, and he was double jointed, so he could actually take the tip of his finger and fold it back. And he said it just depends on a lot of things. He said I may throw a pitch that I never throw again.
It's all feel.
And, I'm not going to compare Marcus Stroman to that, but when I watched him pitch on Saturday, you do get the opinion that there's a lot going on there.
And some of the breaking balls you'll see, they are a little bit different, and could be because one's a slider, one's a curveball, but I don't think that's always the case. I think sometimes you'll see a little bit of a different break. Some might have more depth to it going down, some might come more across, but whatever it is, he's just figuring it out. And as a catcher, you have to know that too, and that's what Deonner's done really well with him, I think. But I think the most important thing is for him to continue to be aggressive with the fastball. First and foremost, I think that's number one for any pitcher, but especially for Marcus, because he's got the high velocity. He's got some movement, and he can locate it. And when he locates it, that's when he's obviously really good. We remember the last time he struggled was at Yankee Stadium. He just didn't have the feel for the baseball. Yeah. And now there's a lot going on there. He's pitching at Yankee Stadium and his near his home, and his family was there, so we'll excuse him. But that's the type of day that you can also have as a pitcher when you just don't have that feel for your delivery or the grip on the ball.
And what I liked about that particular day, though, was the way he was after the game and the way he was on the mound. Like you learn something about a guy by watching how they react when things aren't going well. And what I like about Marcus is we've seen it a couple of times with him. There's no rolling of the eyes or rolling of the shoulders. There's a very... If there is any change, if anything, it's kind of an exhale, and he pulls the cap down even more. And I like seeing that in a young guy. Like, show me that, and the veterans do too. They'll play off that. Show me that you understand what's going on here. It may not be good, but show me that you understand that it's not going good, and we can go from there.
Well, and you talk about hitters dealing with failure, because this game has a lot of failure. Well, pitchers, of course, have failure too. And I always said you don't accept failure. It's how you deal with it. Marcus Stroman deals with it very well. What he does is it motivates him to be better.
It's Baseball Central with Jeff Blair and Joe Siddle. We are brought to you by Home Hardware. Rob Bradford of WEEI.com. He is a very good beat reporter covering the Boston Red Sox. He will join us at 12:40 as we get you set for this four-game series against the Red Sox that I would think for the Toronto Blue Jays. Well, there's a lot on the line for both teams, but especially for the Blue Jays, given how many injuries they have right now. This strikes me, Joe, is it's going to be one of those series where you're obviously going to need good pitching, but you're really going to have to scrape for runs here. And as far as if that's the case, then I think we've seen some things in this Texas series coming out of the All-Star break. We have to like one, Munenori Kawasaki moved into the number two spot by John Gibbons. I think a reflection of the fact that John Gibbons is looking for a hot hand right now. He seems to have found it in Munenori. He's moved him into the number two spot. And they're also getting pretty good at bats from Dan Johnson. I mean, those two guys seem to be in the middle of a lot of things that go on offensively for this team.
I love the move bringing Kawasaki up in the order. And it was started on the West Coast. He's not going to wow you. He's not going to drill balls in the gap. He's not going to hit home runs. But what he's going to do is he is going to, quote, grind out at bats. He's not afraid to take pitches. He'll work pitchers. He's not afraid to be down 0-1 in a count or 1-2. And then when he gets to 1-2, he's reminding me a lot right now of Brett Gardner from the Yankees. He's just a pesky, right, absolute little varmint that you do not want to pitch to. He fouls pitches off, and then he came in yesterday and he really stayed inside a good fastball on the inside and stayed inside it, hit it up the middle for an infield base hit, and he's done it the last 2 days. So those are the quality at bats that you need, and I think at the top of the batting order, it's a nice little mix after Jose and then before Bautista, Melky, those guys down there. It's been good, and Dan's been outstanding. I mean, Dan provides a real professional at bat. He's he had a sac fly the other day, and I talked to him about it yesterday before the game, and it was against that tough lefty, and I said, you know, what are you looking for there? So he kind of talked himself to me through the at-bat. He talked about looking for a ball out over the plate, something elevated. He wants something up in the zone. So we had this long discussion. He successfully hit a sacrifice fly. What did he do yesterday? He got in the same situation, and he popped up to third.
Yeah, I know.
I'm thinking there's no way I should have talked to him. But then he did it later.
He's going to be looking for you.
Exactly.
He's going to be looking for you today.
But that's hitting, right? That's how difficult it is. But the point being, there's a real approach there. There's a real professional approach, and that's what good hitters do. Guys like Dan Johnson don't have the success they've had at the major league level. They can hit. There's a reason why he's here, because he can hit, and he's got a good approach, and he can cause some damage. He's done it in big games too. So look for him to continue. Until Edwin gets back, he's been a pleasant little surprise too, that left-handed bat.
It kind of reminds us, during that Jays hot run in May, they were getting contributions from bench players, Steve Tolleson, Kevin Pillar, Anthony Gose sort of had his little brief spurt. So there was that element when the Jays were having success in May. Now, granted, this is a little different because you don't have Lind, you don't have Encarnacion, and you don't have Lurie, but you do get the sense, and again, you're not going to, let's see what happens against the Red Sox pitchers. It's a different kettle of fish than Texas, but I really got the sense yesterday that there was a real stick-to-itiveness about the Blue Jays that we hadn't seen towards the All-Star break.
Well, it's probably just perfect timing also to play the Texas Rangers. That probably didn't hurt, because this is an offense that was struggling going then against a pitching staff that's really been struggling. It'll be a little different with the Red Sox, but bottom line is your horses have to perform for you to have success. And that means the Reyes, Cabrera, Bautista, Edwin, those guys, when they're not, they have to perform. Now, they cannot perform every game and every at-bat. They're human, too. They're not going to hit 800. So you do need contributions throughout, and I think another one that stepped up for me a little bit, too, is Deonte Navarro. He's been kind of laying a little dormant, but he's come around now, and that's a bat that you have to have. Deonte has to be a big part of this offense, because he is pretty much an everyday catcher. And then Anthony Gose provided a nice little breath of fresh air down there as well. And again, with his speed, the excitement he can provide, I love him in the nine hole. So there's things that you have to count on the big boys, but at the same time, you still need contributions throughout. And when they were going good, they were getting contributions throughout that lineup.
It's Jeff Blair and Joe Siddle. It is Baseball Central on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network. Rob Bradford of WEEI in Boston will join us at 12:40. We'll talk a little Red Sox. But the other story this weekend, a dominant story, and one that Alex Anthopoulos, I'm going to say, attempted to address on Sunday. There was some damn fine tap dancing. It's one of Alex's better tap dancing routines I've seen. Bob Elliott of the Toronto Sun sending out a tweet on Friday night that the Jays were telling teams that they can't take on payroll. They can't take on money in any trade at the deadline. I had a brief conversation with somebody at here in Rogers, and you know, asked them about that, and their response was, well, it's news to me that that's the case. And I'm not calling into question Bob Elliott's reporting. I mean, essentially, I've got an off the record or an anonymous comment talking about Bob's anonymous comment, but
a lot of anonymity.
There's a crap load of anonymity involved there. But, you know, a couple of things to keep in mind here. First of all, when you do acquire a player at the trade deadline, you are picking up a prorated portion of his payroll. So if somebody's making $10 million a year or $8 million a year, you're picking up roughly $4 million of that. So it's a little less draconian than it seems. And as far as acquiring somebody who's under contract for next year as well, the thing people have to keep in mind, one of the things you have to keep in mind is just conservatively, the Jays have about $40 million bucks coming that they can take off the books next year if they want. And I'll walk you through it very quickly. I mean, I don't think either Melky or Colby Rasmus are coming back. That's $15 million worth of player this year. Brandon Morrow's got a $10 million club option for next year. I can't see the Blue Jays picking that up. Adam Lind has a $7.5 million option. Perhaps you pick that up. Jay Happ at $6.5 million. Not certain that's going to happen. Sergio Santos, $6 million. Not certain that's going to happen. And Casey, the three free agents are Casey Jansen, Melky Cabrera, Colby Rasmus. I would think you'd probably want to re-sign Casey. He's making $4 million. But beyond that, Batista, Dickey, and Edwin Encarnacion, they make roughly the same thing they're making this year. Mark Burley goes up to $19 million. That's a $1 million increase from this year. Jose Reyes does get a big $6 million bump next year for the first of 3 years where he's making $22. But essentially, so the idea that you can't make a deal for somebody who's under contract next year really doesn't fly. It's, you know, I asked Alex, Joe, early in the season when the report came out about the Jays deferring salary for Irvin Santana. I said, so does that mean that you can't talk to Colby Rasmus or Melky Cabrera about an extension? And this is back when we thought that might be the case. He said, well, no, because that doesn't count against this year's payroll. That counts against next year's payroll. So whatever I have to do this year to address the 2014 payroll, it doesn't have anything to do with 2015. Bottom line is, I think, Joe, as you said, I think the players expect a deal. I think some of the veterans here will be really annoyed if something isn't done to address this situation, because the veterans know that something had to be done even when everybody was healthy. Even when you had Enwin and you had Brett, you still had a couple of holes, bullpen and second base.
Well, if I'm a Melky or a Jose or Reyes or Bautista or Edwin, Lind, these guys, you know, your window is slowly closing too, and this could be the best chance they've got to win. And if I'm a veteran guy right now in that clubhouse, and I haven't talked to any of them mm-hmm. about this yet, but if I'm one of those guys, I'm thinking, push some buttons here. We need to win now. Now, it's easier said than done. There's a lot of issues still with this team. We know the bullpen's been an issue. Mm-hmm. We know they could use another arm in that rotation. The infield's got an issue, so there's a lot of holes too. So if you get one or two players, are you going to give up some of your future, your top prospects, to fill a couple of holes that may give you a shot to win the AL East or sneak into a wild card? If you're going to do that, making the playoffs is a wonderful thing, but you still need to be well-equipped to beat the Tigers, to beat the Oakland A's, teams like that, the Angels, whoever comes out of the West in the wild card. But that's a tough question. It's a real tough question, but you have to weigh all of those things. But in answer to your question, yeah, if I'm a veteran player, I'm like, let's go for it now, because you have to be a little bit selfish.
Right, and I think, you know, one of the approaches, one of the things Alex has started talking about in the last week is he's talked a little bit less about making a deal at the trade deadline and throwing out an example of the Pittsburgh Pirates last year, who got they got Marlon Byrd and John Buck and Justin Morneau. They got Morneau on August 30th. And, you know, what Alex isn't seeing is if you do that, you're basically getting a guy for a month's salary, which now you're talking $1 million, maybe $1.5 million.
How about their eligibility for the playoffs?
Well, if you get him as long as you get him by August, you're okay. The end of August, because Morneau was on the playoffs. But you have to get them before you set the playoff roster. But I guess my point is, perhaps it's going to be one of those years where we look at the Jays making moves after the trade deadline. Those normally involve players to be named later, the infamous players to be named later.
Putting players on waivers.
My one concern about this, and here's where I think this goes, because I think this is basically the same as it was when J.P. Ricciardi ran the team. J.P. Ricciardi said, I can go, at this time it was Paul Godfrey, I can go to Paul and say, Paul, we need to make this move now. Paul can take it to the Rogers board. And JP said, I think I can do that once a year. He said, I'm not going back twice. But he said, I think I can do that once a year. And I think that's sort of the nut of the issue here, is I think Alex has one shot to make his case. So I what I'm saying is, I don't think it's as open or closed necessarily as closed a case as people think it is.
And I bet it has more to do with what that deal is going to be.
Yeah.
Is this the deal that's going to, A, give us a chance to win right now, but B, you have to think about the future a little bit as well.
Well, and the bizarre thing too, Joe, is this report is out. Bob Elliott's report is out. Ken Rosenthal, pretty good reporter. He's reporting that the Jays have inquired, are still inquiring at Chase Headley. Nick Cafardo, the Boston Globe, the Jays have inquired about Chase Utley. So you're getting these contravening reports here. And look, I think it's pretty clear. If Alex is going to add a sizable contract, he's going to have to be a little creative. There are a lot of other general managers in that area as well. What would concern me, the one thing that would concern me about this is it would appear to tie Alex's hands when it comes to throwing in money to get a deal done. In other words, if I can get a good player, I may have to move somebody. I'm going to just throw Colby Rasmus out there, for example. I may have to move him and put $2 million or $1.5 million in as a make weight in the deal. This kind of ties Alex's hands in that regard. That would be my one concern. But
that's where the word creative comes in.
Exactly. And anyhow, it's clearly something. It's something to monitor, and it makes sense that the fan base would be concerned about it because we've been saying, gosh, for a month that we expect Alex to be active. And some of us have been saying for a month that, you know, we think Alex already should have been active, that there were question marks around this team, even when they were winning, that needed to be addressed. But it's like anything else, Joe. I keep telling people, you may sit here and say, we've got all these prospects or we've got these three prospects and we can move that. But if other people don't see your prospects the same way you see, it doesn't matter what you, Baseball America, Jeff Blair, anybody says about how good a prospect is.
Yeah, it's a two-way street. That's right. And the best trades are when it's a win-win and both teams benefit, whether it's positionally and whose needs are what. But I think the other thing is there's nothing to say that you go out and get bona fide major leaguers now to make a run here and win it. There's nothing to say that that's guaranteed you're going to win it. There's also nothing to say that these prized prospects that you have are going to pan out as good major league prospects. That's why the name of the game is scouting, developing, and really being able to put a finger on the future and being able to be accurate with your evaluations.
Speaking of prospects, Aaron Sanchez, as you know, we reported late last week, has been moved to the bullpen in Buffalo. He's made two starts out of the bullpen, an inning each. Friday came out of the bullpen. Thursday came out of the bullpen. Whatever the 17th is, came out of the bullpen on Thursday. Three hits, two runs, one earned, had two strikeouts. Pitched on Sunday, an inning, one hit. Faced three batters, the minimum, got a double play as well. So those are his two outings out of the bullpen right now. I want to ask you, Joe, that it seems pretty clear that the Jays are going to bring Aaron Sanchez up. I've been told he could be up with the big league team next weekend, pitching out of the bullpen for two reasons. One, it's a way of ensuring he gets regular work without worrying about his innings. But secondly, it also ensures that the Jays have another power arm in the bullpen, which it appears as if they desperately need right now. Do you like the idea of Aaron Sanchez in the bullpen, coming up here, maybe contributing out of the bullpen, then coming back next year and trying to get a starter's job?
Yeah, I love the idea. And we can circa Marcus Stroman. Now, this is what Stroman did when he came from Buffalo. Now, the issue with that
seamless, though, when he came up from Buffalo.
No, it wasn't. And he came as a starter into the bullpen. Now, that's a whole different ball of wax because it's a different routine. It's a different schedule than that you normally follow. So for Sanchez, though, I still say go for it. Marcus had his bumps and bruises here out of the bullpen. He also pitched well at times. Clearly, his future was as a starter. I think we can speak in the same vein about Aaron Sanchez. So why not come up, get him in the bullpen? And that doesn't mean he's going to do exactly what Marcus did. He may come up and do very well and make that transition seamless. But I think it's a great way to break him in. And the other thing here, I think the most important thing is you're also limiting his innings and controlling his innings. If he's going to be in Buffalo pitching for another month or two, why not have him here? If you think he's ready, and I think everybody thinks he's ready, at least to give it a shot. Hey, if it works out terribly, you send him back down and you start the experiment maybe again next year. But I think why not? This could be an arm. This would be best case scenario. This could be an arm that you bring up in the bullpen, and it's like acquiring a good arm in a trade. And that's what they need right now is another arm in that bullpen for sure.
Yeah, and I do want to touch on Casey Jansen as well before we take the break. Casey wasn't used on Saturday. Red flags went up everywhere. The reason was he had the flu. Apparently he went down to the Dominican Republic during the All-Star break and came back with a case of, I don't know what you call the Dominican version of Montezuma's revenge, but whatever.
Some sort of virus, yep.
Yeah, anyhow, did not feel very good. Came into yesterday's game and ended up having to be rescued by Aaron Loop. And did you look at that, Joe, as just a guy who was feeling under the weather? He didn't seem to have it almost right from the start, it seemed to me. It's almost like it just didn't look the same, and then he seemed to run into a wall very early.
Well, I think the best thing that happened yesterday was the Blue Jays tacking on a few runs there in the bottom of the eighth, because that gave that cushion. But I like the fact that John Gibbons went to Casey Jansen anyway. He's coming off an illness, and everybody's been sick at one time or another. And when you have to now perform on a Major League Baseball field with the best in the world and you haven't been feeling well, it's not easy. So I think it was perfect that it was not a one-run game or a tight ball game for Casey to come into. Clearly, he wasn't himself yesterday, but you know what? I think the best thing was that he went out there, got some work in. It's almost like throwing a good bullpen session, except it was in a game environment, which is even better. Got some work in. Aaron Loop was able to come close the door because they had that cushion. And then now, hopefully, Casey continues to feel better each day physically with his illness and gets back at it on the mound. I'm sure he'll be pretty well back to normal next time we see him.
Should mention, by the way, that according to SB Nation, Chris Cotillo, Dan Uggla has cleared waivers and is now officially a free agent. I asked somebody with the Jays on Friday, would you be interested in Dan Uggla, second baseman who, I don't even know what he did. Well, frankly, nobody knows what he did to get out of Atlanta. The last straw appears to be reporting late for a game, but he's had some issues. He's been unhappy in Atlanta for a while. And I asked a Jays source, look, this is a second baseman. This is a guy you used to have interest in. And the response I got was, until we know more about the story out of Atlanta, we're not all that interested in him. So I don't know necessarily what's going on there, but I would be surprised if the Jays would take a shot at Dan Uggla right now. That's my initial reading on it, but we'll certainly stay on top of that. The Jays and Boston Red Sox start a four-game series tonight at the Rogers Center. Rob Bradford of WEEI in Boston will join us. And I also want to take a look at Mike Trout yesterday. A little bit of interaction between Mike Trout, Albert Pujols, and Fernando Rodney during a game. We'll deal with that when Baseball Central continues. Brought to you, as always, by Home Hardware on the Sportsnet Radio and TV Network. All right, welcome back to Baseball Central. Jeff Blair and Joe Siddle for your listening and viewing pleasure. We are brought to you, as always, by our friends at Home Hardware. A couple of little newsy items before we get to Rob Bradford of WEEI. You know, of course, I've already reported that the Atlanta Braves have released Dan Uggla. I would be surprised if the Jays make a play for him. Trade on the weekend, the Los Angeles Angels acquiring relief pitcher Houston Street and a pitching prospect Trevor Gott from the Padres. In return, the Padres get four prospects, two of them really good. Taylor Lindsay, a second baseman that is considered to be the Angels' top prospect. RJ Alvarez, a pitcher. Jose Rondon, shortstop. And another pitcher, Elliot Morris. Pretty good haul. Pretty good haul for the San Diego Padres, who have another couple of players that people are interested in, one of them being Chase Headley. Kind of a funny incident in the eighth inning on Sunday between the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim and the Seattle Mariners. Mike Trout and Albert Pujols facing Fernando Rodney, Seattle's closer. Now, Fernando Rodney does the arrow thing, Joe Siddle, whenever he whenever he strikes anybody out or gets to a big point in the game. And Mike Trout and Albert Pujols both turned the tables on him. Trout crosses home plate, pulls out an arrow. So does Pujols, pulls out an arrow and at Rodney. And afterwards, Fernando Rodney remarked that, I'm friends with everybody in baseball. And I think everybody sort of took it in the right vein. Although you brought up, it's closers do things like that. Relievers do things like that. Probably not a good idea to do it in the eighth inning when you got another inning left to play.
I wonder if Fernando even knew it was the eighth inning.
Well, there was a lot of that going around this weekend. Adam Jones forgot the number of outs in a play, but stuff like that. Did that bother you when you were a player?
Well, you know, the best part of what we saw right there is that it looked like everybody had fun with it, including Fernando Rodney, when Trout and Pujols went right back at you, basically. He had fun with it after the game. His comments weren't, he wasn't upset about it. Now, I have a problem with what he does in the first place. Now, whatever happened to a good fist pump when you're really pumped up after a good save or just a good high five? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, the antics anymore, and you're seeing it after home runs now. Guys are running down the gauntlet in the dugout. I mean, it's just becoming a show, and maybe fans like that. I don't know. It's a little much for me, but pulling an arrow from your back and shooting an arrow when you get a save, that's way too much for me. I've never liked that from Rodney, not to mention his hat being on sideways, but at least in this situation, they had fun with it. To see two guys like Trout and Pujols take part, that surprised me a little bit, to be honest with you. And I'm sure that was just the emotion of the moment that they did that. Whether they would take that back or not, I'm not sure. But at least it was smoothed over because they did have fun with it.
Yeah, and, you know, actually, we were talking about Marcus Stroman earlier. I will be interested to see, once he establishes himself in the majors, what Marcus Stroman does. Because he's got the fist, he's done a couple of things. He's got the fist pump. He's got the kind of the little hop, the look away.
And I like them all.
Yeah.
I've loved what I've seen from Marcus Stroman. And I don't think Marcus Stroman is a guy that's ever going to, I may be wrong, but I'm going to make a prediction right now. He is not going to be one of those guys. Here's a guy, and we've heard his story. He's been brought up. His parents have taught him well. He's an educated kid. And I just believe that's not going to be in his character. A fist pump, a look, a pump with the body, whatever it takes, that's all wonderful. Nothing is ever really directed at the hitter when he does it. So I wouldn't even go there with Marcus. I love what I see from him, and I don't see it getting any worse.
Yeah, he does. I noticed the game against Texas on Saturday, he did the little pump, but he made sure that he wasn't looking at anybody
when he
did it. And made sure that he was looking in a general direction.
It's emotion, too, though. I mean, when you make a big pitch in a big situation, strike somebody out, you almost don't even realize what you're doing sometimes. You just react, and that's that emotion, and I really believe it's true emotion coming from Marcus.
Marcus Stroman gets the start against the Red Sox on Thursday. That is a Thursday afternoon game against Ruby De La Rosa. Wednesday, it'll be R.A. Dickey against Clay Buchholz. Tuesday, Jay Happ against Jake Peavy. Tonight, Drew Hutchison against John Lackey. The Boston Red Sox in town for four games. Don't look now, but the Red Sox have won four in a row. They're 7.5 back, tied with Tampa 7.5 back. Toronto's 3 back. Yankees are 3 back. Baltimore is leading. And the American League East is tightening up. Rob Bradford of WEEI in Boston, one of our favorites, joins us on Baseball Central. And Rob, I thought Boston had packed it in. Weren't they getting rid of all their old guys and bringing up all their young guys?
You have to go a long way in Boston. You have to be really, really out of it for them to admit they're going to pack it in. You know that.
It's almost like close your eyes, you know, open your eyes, and you're in a pennant race.
Well, you know, I think that they're going to go. They were going to get to the trade deadline no matter what, because, as I said, they invest so much money in this. The fan base, if you tell them they're going to sell, no, that won't go over well for a long, long time. So if there's a glimmer of hope, they're going to grab onto it. And it just so happens that glimmer of hope reappeared, thanks in part, by the way, to the White Sox and the Houston Astros. So, you know, now they beat Kansas City, a pretty respectable team, and we'll see where it goes against Toronto.
Rob, when you talk about, or people talk about, the World Series hangover, now, when I say that, what I think of is the long season, what you have to do, and everything has to really go right all year long to win a World Series, but you're going deep into the season, the offseason's shorter for players. Are those factors here? To me right now, when I look at Boston Red Sox, it's a team that's just scuffling offensively.
Yeah, it's a good question. And you know, they head into their spring training with their eyes wide open. They drew back on their starting pitching, knowing they had an increased workload in October. But they go into the year, and I think the biggest mistake they made were they didn't account enough for the depth to replace the guys they lost. In other words, they lost Jacoby Ellsbury. They replaced him with Jackie Bradley, who's hit around 210 most of the year. Stephen Drew, you didn't replace him, really. And then when you brought him back, he had 2.5 months off, so he wasn't in the flow of things at all. Daniel Nava was a hugely important guy. They set him back down after 2.5 weeks in the season, And finally, they got him back going now. And then, you know, A.J. Pierzynski replacing Jared Saltalamacchia, a bad idea from the get-go, never worked out. Now they have Christian Vasquez up, who's had some life, just some things. So I think they just undervalued, I think, what they had to do to replace the guys, and key guys they lost.
Rob Bradford of WEEI joins us on Baseball Central. So the Red Sox come into Toronto for a four-game series. It's artificial turf. I know that they're, I think Shane Victorino came back on the weekend. Is this going to create an issue for John Farrell and create an issue in terms of how he's going to use players over these four games? So I think they've got seven games in turf. Actually, they go to Tampa.
Yeah, it's a great point. And in Victorino, they want to squeeze out as much as they can off of the second half, but they have to be very wary. Every time they bring him back, he has some sort of relapse with his hamstring or his back. So I do think they're going to be careful. And then the other guy, obviously, Jeff, is David Ortiz. David Ortiz is such a huge part of this lineup, even though he didn't do much against Kansas City. And we know that just even running the bases, sometimes that takes a toll on his calves and his feet on that turf. So it will be interesting to see how he manages it, because there are key guys they have to keep in the lineup to keep things going. Because as you guys mentioned before, the offense by far has been the biggest issue with this team.
He says he's going to be hotter than Jamaica. I'm about to get hotter than Jamaica in the middle of August, according to your colleague Alex Speer. Is that?
I know. I didn't know. And I asked Alex this. Did he mean that he was getting hotter than Jamaica in August or Jamaica in August? Because I'm like, if it's Jamaica in August, then why are you waiting to August to get hot as Jamaica? I wasn't quite clear on that. Alex, as always, clarified that for me.
But as one of the things we know about David Ortiz is, you know, he does tend to back up his words every now and then, doesn't he?
Well, Jeff, I would say this, that, you know, through all the bluster of Ortiz, through all the controversy, you know, through all the ill-timed comments, contract and scoring decisions and everything else, the Red Sox would be in a pitiful spot without him. Mm. He supplies such an enormous part of that lineup. And something that, to be honest with you, I don't know how they're going to replace when he's gone. They don't have very many power bats in the system at all. It's the hardest thing to find in baseball right now. And why he doesn't have a 950 OPS of a year ago, he still has about an 860 OPS. He's doing okay. And they desperately need him. So I think that people get caught up in the personality of David Ortiz and the controversy of David Ortiz. The one thing the Red Sox have to take stock of, 38 years old or not, he is maybe the most important guy on this team right now.
Right, and he was 1-for-13 in that Kansas City series, yeah. By the way.
And talking about offense, Rob, how about Brock Holt and his contribution in playing all over the field? I know Bogaerts has not had the year that the Red Sox has anticipated. What do you make of that, what Brock Holt has provided?
I mean, we talk about key guys and guys they can't do without. It is amazing. It's to think that Brock Holt, the guy who lost out on the utility job in spring training, has become one of the most valuable guys of this team. Valuable because he's moved all over the diamond. He's moved all over the outfield, the infield, and played well wherever he's gone. But I think also, maybe most important, is that he's been their leadoff hitter. I mean, you took Ellsbury out, and you were hoping that Nava and Victorino would slide in, which wasn't a perfect solution. And then all of a sudden, Holt appears, and since he's been put in the leadoff spot, he has more hits than any other leadoff hitter in the major league. This is, again, a guy, guys, this was the throw-in in the Joel Hanrahan trade who started the year in the minor league. So, yeah, he is a very, very valuable guy, and good for him. I mean, he was given a chance. He made the most of it.
Rob, it was good of you to do this, as always. Thanks so much. Rob Bradford of WEEI. For Joe Siddle, Rob Bradford, I'm Jeff Blair. Don't forget, first of four games, Red Sox, Blue Jays, tonight at the Rogers Center. John Lackey, Drew Hutchison. Been Baseball Central, brought to you by Home Hardware. Talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.